Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Beginnings matter. That's the gist of a documentary film on early childhood intelligence and education. No Small Matter calls early childhood a grown-up issue that has attracted plenty of research about early brain development and the importance of parent-child interaction starting at birth. Greg Jacobs is a filmmaker, producer, and co-director of No Small Matter. He joins us. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
I start the show the way you started your film, with the notion that beginnings matter. It seems kind of prosaic, but it's actually pretty complicated.
For a long time, we seriously considered calling the movie Duh. Because it's so, once you understand all of it, it's so self-evident that this is the most powerful, most important investment we should be making as a country. But the problem is that there's a lot of complicated stuff that goes into getting to the point of Duh.
You know, the film immediately addresses, I mean, even during the early credits, the larger societal impact of on learning and the referencing early society and contrasting it with modern society. And tell us about why that was relevant, what's changed and how it is relevant.
Yeah, we often describe it as the movie's really about, if you think there is some wisdom in the phrase, it takes a village to raise a child. What happens when the village is gone and nothing has replaced it? And that's kind of where we find ourselves now as a society. So we wanted to really start the film by reminding people that this is something that gets that goes beyond today. It goes beyond just our country or national boundaries. It's really a basic human biological thing to have lots of people taking care of babies and young children for a lot longer than any other animal, because that's what allows us to become human. So we wanted to start it really with all the way back in, you know, like caveman times, mm-hmm. basically.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty kind of breathtaking when you're depicting him kind of in stick figures, I guess, the human interactions that a child during, you know, in early societies, they were constantly with their parents or a caretaker and constantly learning. That's how they grew up in their society. And then you introduce the cell phone and you have the cell phone light up in someone's pocket. They get up and they walk away.
Right. Exactly. There is what the science has been showing really over the last 20 years is that the thing that builds a healthy brain is the back and forth interaction between adults and the infant or the young child. And it makes a lot of sense when you start to think about it, because if you are a baby, you know, in the Serengeti in prehistoric times, and you don't hear anything, you start crying, you have a need, and you don't get anything back from the grown-ups, that means pretty much you're not going to survive. So babies are extraordinary creatures at figuring out ways to communicate their needs to the people around them, who are their protectors first, and then eventually their teachers. Because the brain, we are born with brains that are not fully formed, and the reason we have such a young childhood seems to be, or such a long childhood, seems to be that it allows us to kind of shape our brains to meet the culture and the environment that we are in. And so that takes a long time, but that's what the grown-ups are there for.
You know, when you say long childhood, a lot of people think, hey, he's still a child.
Yeah. You mean in terms of...
You can put that off. You know, rush. Let him be a kid, that kind of a thing. But there's a double-edged sword to that, right?
Well, I think let him be a kid is great. Mm-hmm. I think that's, you know, we want people to have the freedom to raise kids the way they want, and to have the kids have not to have worries and not to have stress. And I think really, this is one of the common misperceptions, I think, when people hear the issue early childhood education, is that it's about somehow dropping babies into school, mm-hmm. and making 9-month-olds do worksheets. And it's actually the exact opposite. It's really about the entire ecosystem that a baby or young child grows up in, the ecosystem of relationships. So just making sure that everywhere they are is a learning experience and a crucial experience, but making sure that the people who are around them are taking care of them, protecting them, and loving them.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about early childhood education. My guest, Greg Jacobs, he's a filmmaker, producer, and co-director of the documentary No Small Matter. It is screening Wednesday night at Nationwide Children's Hospital. The screening is free and open to the public. Check out our website at WOSU.org/allsides for more information about how to get there. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Some people think the prospect of everywhere there is a learning experience for a child sounds kind of exhausting in a way. That's not really what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think sometimes people take that message as, oh my gosh, I have to run home and read, you know, the encyclopedia to my child. And that's really not the case at all. What we're talking about fundamentally is just a kind of basic, healthy growth of the brain and body. And as long as kids have some, you know, someone or people around them who are keeping them safe and protecting them and interacting with them in an engaged way, basically things are going to go okay. There's it kind of rolls out the way it should. What really can cause problems is when there are grown-ups around them who either won't or can't take care of them, or can't engage in the way that they, the kind of give the kind of engagement that they really need to have that back and forth that builds the brain, and that's where some of the challenges that families face in our current society and our current economy. That's when those come into play. You know, if you are a single mother and you're working two or three jobs, where does that come from, and where does that energy come from?
It comes from the child.
Yes, it comes from
your interaction. You subtract it from the time you spend with your child.
Right, exactly. It is a, you know, it can be a zero sum game, and so there is, you know, there's a sense that oh my gosh, if I'm not reading to my child, if I'm not, you know, interacting in a concretely educational way with my child, then I'm not doing my job, and that's not the case at all. It's really the kind of informal, just, you know, the singing to your kid or bathing your kid or, you know, fixing dinner for your kid. It's those times where the child comes to understand what support is, what love is, and how to have that kind of back and forth.
There is some absolute brain chemistry going on in all of this, and we're going to talk about it later, but I remember a TED talk about when a child learned to say the word water and where it was, and some guy filmed his entire house everywhere the kid went and every word that was spoken, and I don't know how he did it, you know, it was a genius, but it was in the kitchen. It can be, you can pinpoint things like that now, right? As far as how the brain works and where it works.
The technology that has developed over the last couple decades is really extraordinary, and one of the things that's happened because of that is that the science has kind of surpassed what we generally think as a society about those early years. So we're still trying to catch up to what the science has told us. And one of the consequences of that is for a long time, you know, we've always known that a challenging beginning, a bad beginning, you know, makes the odds of a challenging outcome or a bad outcome much greater. So, you know, the child is the father to the man kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But we never knew why. And what was inside the brain, a baby's brain, was a total black box. But in recent years, the science has started to kind of unlock or look under the hood, unlock the black box, and see the mechanisms that connect a good beginning to a good outcome or a bad beginning to a bad outcome. And they can do it with incredible precision mm-hmm. now. So there are, you know, the thing that turns out to be happening there, the machinery, is so affected by stress and adverse experiences that it has really long-lasting biological changes to the body and brain. And that is, the really big advancement. That what it does is it takes it out of the moral universe. So it's no longer, we don't know why this happened, but it must be something wrong with the parents. They must be bad parents, or that must be a bad child. And now there's kind of a neutral referee, the biology that we're coming to understand, that says, no, it's not, this isn't a moral thing. This is physical changes to the brain and body, and we can fix that and address it. And that's a very powerful shift.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the question over, you know, over the my four decades in journalism and asking these questions about education was, why do two kids from low income families, neighborhoods, etc., turn out so differently? And it can be something like the absence of toxic stress in one versus the other.
Absolutely. And it really, you know, one of the last frontiers really is exactly that question, because, you know, you can have two kids who do come from the same environment, who turn out very differently. And it's not just their environment, and it's not just their DNA. It's some mix of the two of them, some dance over the lifetime between the two of those, between nature and nurture, that really makes the difference. And some kids are just born genetically more resilient. And, you know, that's one of the pieces of the science that they're just starting to figure out. There are kids who are, they call them dandelion kids, and other kids who are orchid kids. And the dandelion kids are basically sort of built in a way that they can really withstand, like, a constant awful, and they'll be okay. The orchid kids are much more fragile in the face of that kind of stress. But if you give them the right environment, you give them the hothouse environment, they will thrive even beyond the dandelion kids. And so when you think about it that way, and you think about the enormous amount of talent and you know, artists and business people and innovators that we are losing because we have, you know, orchid children who are not getting that kind of support, it's really tragic.
You talk to teachers at a child care center in Highland Park in Illinois, and they talk about actually teaching their young students how they learn. They actually are using drawings and models of brains and taking them apart and teaching. We're talking 4 or 5 year olds.
It's amazing.
It is
what kids that age can learn once you give them the basic information, and you scaffold where they go with it. One of the things that really stands out, I think, in the film, in no small matter, is that we happen to hit the jackpot with an unbelievable classroom that kind of weaves its way through the film of teachers. And they're just, you know, they're the kind of educators that you want not just your own kid, but every kid to have. And when you see the sort of energy and intentionality that goes into what they do, you realize, A, this is really hard and really complicated, and B, man, look at how those children are thriving with that in their presence. And so there's a sort of, you know, I don't want to do the spoiler alert thing, but there's a bit of a gut punch at the end when you realize what actually happened.
When the teacher asks in one part of the, it was early in the film, I'm not going to do any spoilers, but she asks, when do we start to learn? And I don't know if this kid's been taught this or they just know it innately or whatever, but he says, in playtime.
Right.
Wow. I mean, their whole life is playtime, and he can discern.
Yeah, the it ends up with Ayana in the back of the room saying, when we're born.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the right answer, that we begin learning. I mean, you're really learning even in some ways earlier, but that kind of understanding of the world and that kind of learning is happening from the moment you get out. We show an experiment that one of the psychologists did where they took babies that were maybe 40 minutes old, I think, at the youngest, and would stick out their tongue, and the baby would stick out their tongue, and open their mouth, and the baby would open their mouth. So there was this sense of, like, the baby's never seen its own face. It's never seen any other faces besides this. It doesn't know what a face is. But somehow it has the capacity to understand that that is part of me and that part of the other person is the same, and I can mimic it. And when you see that, you go, oh my gosh, there is so much more going on than we understand.
We are talking about
early childhood intelligence, education, and all of the societal implications around those two issues. My guest is Greg Jacobs. He's a filmmaker, producer, and co-director of the documentary No Small Matter. It is screening Wednesday at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Check out our website at WOSU.org/allsides for more information. It is free and open to the public. We'll continue our conversation, so stay with us. We'd like to hear from you. What do you think about this? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Beginnings matter. That's the upshot of a documentary film on early childhood intelligence and education. No Small Matter calls early childhood a grown-up issue that has attracted plenty of research about early brain development and the importance of parent-child interactions starting at birth. But too often, parents are working two or three jobs just to afford childcare. The childcare may not be the greatest, and educators are often too busy in the end teaching to the test to spend quality time with their students. So we're talking about what we know about the brains of young children and how to make the most of the beginnings. Still with us is filmmaker, producer, and co-director of No Small Matter, Greg Jacobs. Greg, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Once again, the documentary No Small Matter is screening Wednesday at Nationwide Children's Hospital. It's free and open to the public. Check out the link at WOSU.org/allsides for more information about that. Lori Katz is a professor in early childhood education in the Department of Teaching and Learning at Ohio State. She joins us. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Ian.
Lori Katz, how do you study early childhood learning? You've been doing it for a while, so tell us how it's kind of ebbed and flowed or changed over time and what we're doing now.
Well, let me tell you a study that I've just been completing here, and I have been studying infant toddlers in a classroom in the community. And what's the way we've been studying it is we call it some ethnographic perspectives or methods that we use where we become like a participant observer. It's not like we take the child out of the room. We ask them to do in particular activities, but we're studying them in their natural environment. And we look at the early childhood ed setting as their natural environment. So we're not changing anything. Now, I want to say this is one way people are studying. Other people are studying it different ways. Mm-hmm. But we really find when we can videotape their interactions without them knowing that we have a videotape or we're forming relationships with the kids. We're not a teacher per se, but we're an assistant and we interact mm-hmm. with the kids. But when we can look at the videotapes and then we can have the teachers view the videotapes and tell us more about what's going on in the videotapes, it's really powerful. And one of the things that we have found in this study that we have just done is that there's such caring that is going on with infants and toddlers.
What do you mean, caring on their part?
Yes, where we have kids that are hugging each other when somebody is upset. They are hugging, they're saying, I'm sorry.
They're empathetic.
They're so empathetic. And we're trying to say, well, what's going on to make them, so empathetic? Because they're not necessarily being told this is how you, mm-hmm. This is how you act, but they're learning from other kids. They're learning from their teachers. They're learning from, modeling in the classroom. And the teacher is setting up activities where they are learning how to relate to each other, form relationships, interact in appropriate ways, and they understand, they start understanding when somebody cries, when somebody's upset, what you need to do, you know, to help them and move on in that experience.
This all seems like, you know, Greg Jacobs, that this is stuff that kids, of course, are learning to do, but some kids aren't.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for a long time, because there wasn't much until a few decades ago, there wasn't much study of infants and toddlers. In fact, the way Alison Gopnik puts it, that if you kind of read the great literature of history, you would think that for most of human history, we reproduced asexually because there was no evidence of children. and so part of it is the fact that there are now women who have entered the sciences in the last few decades and are studying this, and that there's a premium now being put on it, and there are ways of studying it. And so that has really, I think, brought it not just as an interesting topic, mm-hmm. But as a really essential and completely fascinating field of study.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about early childhood intelligence and education. You just heard Greg Jacobs. He's a filmmaker, producer, and co-director of the documentary No Small Matter. It is screening this week. It's free and open to the public, so check out our website at wosu.org/allsides for more information. Also with us, Lori Katz. She's a professor of early childhood education in the Department of Teaching and Learning at Ohio State. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Jack in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jack.
Hi there, Ann and Greg. Thank you so much for this very interesting conversation. I was struck by your comment about an ecosystem of relationships, I think the way you put it. And it reminded me of a fascinating book by economist Jennifer Roback Morse titled Love and Economics. And the subtitle of her book is It Takes a Family to Raise a Village. And it just struck me from your earlier comments that you seem to be finding that families really are critical in this developmental process for children. I was just curious if you could comment further on that.
Greg Jacobs?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think, you know, we have, first of all, you know, we all can agree that the child's first and most important teacher is the parent. And then you sort of broaden out the concentric circles. So when you think of family, it's not just the parent, but it's also grandparents and cousins and neighbors and friends and coaches and teachers. And pretty soon, you know, that family is an entire extended environment. So I think we always think of this issue as not about children, but always about families, because children live in families, and you can't separate the two-year-old from that environment. So when we talk about whatever policies might be necessary to improve what we do, it's always in the context of supporting families with babies and young children.
Yeah. Lori Katz?
Yes, these types of relationships are so important. And one of the things that we're doing in our teacher preparation program at Ohio State is really promoting family-school relationships, whether they be family, early childhood relationships, because they have to be together. And this is where families and educators become partners. It's not that the educator is the expert and that tells the parent what to do, but they learn from each other. So this is really critical as where, you know, as we have more children in early childhood ed settings and going on into kindergarten and upper grades, is we can't not ignore the child and the context of the family. The family is very much part of the child. And the child doesn't come into a early childhood ed setting like a blank slate. They come in already with a number of experiences that they've had from their families. And we need to be not only culturally responsive, but culturally sustaining in terms of how we bring those, our that cultural responsiveness and sustaining information from the families into those classrooms.
Some people think that when we're talking about a family, we're talking about the nuclear family, the mom and the dad, and this real traditional thing. Is there any evidence to support that is what the makeup of a family is affects that?
It's not the makeup of the family, but when Greg was talking before in terms of resilience, there's a historical study that was done to look at people who were at risk and why they became so successful. And a lot of them go back and say, it was because I had a model in my family, in the community, or my teacher. At some point in their lives that really, they started believing in them. And these, so what happens is when you have, you know, people in the community, family, schools saying, I believe in you, you can do it. So we really want and we encourage our teacher educators to build on the children's strengths and the cultural resources that they bring to the classroom. So when we teach, we're not just teaching about cognitive development, but we're teaching about social skills. We're teaching about communication, really how to prepare our children to be successful in the world.
Greg Jacobs, 30 years ago when Ohio started the unendable debate about school funding and how it works, I profiled two school districts in Ohio. I profiled what was at that time the poorest district per pupil funding, that kind of a thing, and the wealthiest district, the highest per pupil funding. It wasn't the funding that was so startling to me. It was the world that they lived in. In the poorest district, it happened to be a rural district. There were no museums. There were no swimming pools. There were no lawyers. There were no doctors. The most elevated people in the community were the teachers. And in the other school district, there not only were a plethora of libraries and bookstores and all kinds of things, but they were actually teaching the kids how to make a book when I was visiting that day. They were binding books for them. It wasn't the per pupil funding that made the difference. It was this whole other layer of environment and exposure to things.
Yeah, and I would suspect it's some kind of really toxic combination of the two. That you know, when we talk about this a lot of times, and when we lay it out in the film, what we talk about is essentially it boils down to there are babies and young children, and we're talking about kids 1, 2 years old, 3 years old, who are getting not enough of the good stuff and too much of the bad stuff. And there's a concept called toxic stress, which is essentially when a child is under a sort of constant source of stress but doesn't have a grown-up to buffer that stress and support them, it changes the development of their brain and body in ways that are damaging for a lifetime. And that it's not poor or rich, because you can both, you know, it doesn't matter which class you come from, it can happen to both. But the odds for low-income families are much, much greater that a child will experience toxic stress. And so what they are often not getting is the kind of interactions that you're talking about, all that extra stuff, the summer programs and the books in the household and the trips to places like parks and museums and just the positive interactions all around them. So that's the good stuff that builds the really healthy brain. But they're also getting too much of the bad stuff, which is, you know, it could be an incarcerated parent or addiction in the home or a violent neighborhood or abuse or most commonly neglect. And that then affects the brain and the development of these systems in ways that can shape you for a lifetime. So it's a double whammy that children 2, 3, 4 years old are facing through no fault of their own. So by the time they get to kindergarten, their brains and their bodies are adapted for that environment, but not for an environment like a classroom. So they become often labeled. These are problem children, but they're just responding the way they would normally do in their environment. It's just inappropriate for a class.
And it's literally how the brain is working. It's not a conscious necessarily, this is how I learned to do things and therefore I'm going to do it. It's a chemical thing.
You don't want to sort of just write it off as inevitable or anything like
that.
But yes, it is. What they're finding is that the brain is built in layers over time, and when you have circuits that are not formed in the strongest way at the beginning, it creates a more fragile foundation that then becomes much more expensive and much more challenging to fix as the brain sort of solidifies. And so that's why people talk about the investment aspect of this, that if we help children at that earliest, most plastic age, that will impact them for the rest of their lives. But if we try to help them when they're 15 or when they're 30 or when they're 50, it's a very, very heavy, very expensive lift.
Greg, Cookie Monster jumps into the film at one point.
Spoiler alert.
Millions upon millions of people have credited public television shows, and I'm not just, tooting our horn here, like The Muppets and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, for sort of saving their intellectual lives. It was, a refuge, an oasis. Does television have the capacity to do that much good, or are we kidding ourselves?
First of all, I should say to people, if you want to see Cookie Monster sing Total Eclipse of the Heart, you should come out to see the film tomorrow night. You will not forget that. But I think what they're fundamentally finding is that intentional educational programming, when watched in conjunction with an adult or a parent, can actually be very helpful, especially for children who maybe are where English isn't their primary language, or low-income children who might not have access to other resources. When television is used just as a time killer or a babysitter for long periods of time, I'm not talking about any parent just going, oh, please, I just need you to sit quietly while I make dinner, but really over time, and it's television that is of wildly varying quality or inappropriate for the development of a two-year-old's brain, then I think it can be either neutral or harmful.
And Lori Katz?
Yeah, I would agree with what Greg is saying in terms of TV watching. I think it's really critical that we also think about the relationships that the child is having at home with family members, and that's really important. But yeah, these are great shows, and to have the child watch it with a parent and then maybe read a book. That's a very high quality picture book, and read aloud with that child and connect what's going on. I mean, one of the things that's really important with brain-based learning is the connections that children are making as they're learning things in the environment. So if you can connect what's the type of reading or stories, and reading aloud is just a great way to begin, reading, and children's enjoyment around reading. And of course, we're doing literacy skills so much earlier, mm-hmm. really right from birth.
And just before I let you go, Greg, the film looks at the disparities of wealth and the impact that it has on learning. And to your point, Lori Katz, children from higher incomes hear millions more words, millions more words, for example, by the time they are 3 years old.
It's not just that they hear the words, mm-hmm. it's that the words are addressed to them in ways that are back and forth. Mm. And really, like, the key takeaway in all this is that it's the intentional, contingent back and forth interactions, so that when the child says something, they get a response, and then they can respond to that. And that's the thing that really shapes the brain. So we don't want people to think like, okay, I just need to go home and put on a tape recorder, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. play a spoken word record. That's not going to help. It's just it's really that kind of social communication that is the magic.
Well, Greg Jacobs, I have to let you go, but I do appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, and I hope to see everybody at the movie tomorrow night.
Greg Jacobs, filmmaker, producer, and co-director of No Small Matter. It's a documentary film, and it's screening tomorrow night. I'm sorry, Wednesday night at Nationwide Children's Hospital. It's free and open to the public, so check out the link at WOSU.org/allsides for more information. We will continue our conversation. We're going to hear about what the DeWine administration is doing, Governor DeWine is doing from where he sits, signing into law in the latest budget, several programs or increasing funding for several early childhood programs. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about early childhood learning and how it translates into the classroom and our homes. Still with us is professor in early childhood education in the Department of Teaching and Learning at Ohio State, Lori Katz. Kara Wente is the Assistant Director for Health and Human Services at the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services. The current fiscal budget was signed into law in July. The DeWine administration reinforced a handful of early childhood learning programs, including $30 million increase over 2 years for the Help Me Grow program. Kara Wente, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
When I was reading about the Help Me Grow program, it described it as evidence-based home visiting program. What's the evidence that matters? How so is it evidence-based?
Well, and Help Me Grow, the evidence-based practice is actually one that they have fostered for years. They have looked into the many studies that are really showing results with the children in the homes and focused on making sure that those long-term impacts are sustained.
And so when it says evidence-based, what kind of evidence are we talking about?
Generally, they're looking at studies that have been validated and used in the field to ensure that they are having the impacts that they are saying they are.
Mm-hmm.
They are looking at making sure that if they are looking to change a family's habits or culture, that those evidence-based practices are sustaining that promise.
And Lori Katz, as far as those kind of studies go, how do you check those studies? How do we know?
There was a series of studies done in the 60s and 70s when they really were looking at, does early childhood education have an impact on families? And what they did with this is they also worked very closely with the family. So they made a lot of home visits, and then they looked at the gains that children were making, because what they were doing with the families is that they were teaching them how to promote their child's development and taking, and they used to actually have a volunteer that would come in the house and work with the family. So the relationship that you had with the family was extremely important for the family to take this information
and embrace it
and understand it, because we know even as kids get older that you have trusting relationships between the teachers and the families. You see an increase in academic development, academic achievement. So they were finding that kids' social emotional development from assessments that they were doing afterwards were really increasing because of the work that the families were doing together with the visitor and also having those children in early childhood ed settings. So it just wasn't alone. It just wasn't just the parent-child relationship, but back to taking a village, it was also having that child in a high-quality early childhood ed setting that was really critical.
You know, Kirawenty, $20 million in the budget was devoted to so-called quality infrastructure grants to enhance Ohio's child care system. What is that money going to be spent on? What are we talking about there?
I think, Anne, it goes back to that holistic approach, whether it's Help Me Grow or early childhood learning and development. The $20 million in quality infrastructure was dedicated to kind of round that service realm out. It is focused on making sure that our providers who have to participate in the step up to quality early learning improvement system by July 1, 2020, have the resources they need to really move forward and move the needle to ensure that they are meeting the quality standards established by the Ohio Department of Education and the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services.
So when we talk about infrastructure, is that stuff or is that people?
It could be either.
Okay.
Right now, we're still trying to define what the $10 million in each fiscal year is going to fully be utilized for.
Mm-hmm.
We're leveraging our communities, our providers, to say where are our needs still at? That deadline is coming quickly, and we're really trying to assess the programs that aren't yet participating, what do they need, and those that are, how do they sustain and maintain? That ranges from everything from training and professional development to true infrastructure, or the purchase of possibly curriculums and assessments that they can make sure that they're evaluating those children along the way and giving them the services they need.
Is it, as far as training and professional development goes, Lori Katz, you know, when I was looking at the film No Small Matter, you can't help but be struck by the quality of the educators in this that they're following in the film. I mean, they're amazing people. And I'm wondering, is that something you can teach? I mean, in the process of what you do, do you sometimes find people that you just don't think are going to be a good fit for early childhood development?
Sure. We have to look at both dispositions as well as developing skills and knowledge for them to work with the children. You can't just come into a program and just say, I want to be an early childhood educator because I love children.
Mm-hmm.
You really need, I think, a disposition, a passion, an understanding that this is really hard, difficult work that you're not necessarily going to get a lot of money for to do.
Well, that's an issue, isn't it?
Yes, it's an extremely big issue.
Yeah.
Extremely.
Kirawenty, what about that? I mean, early childhood educators are so underpaid. Everybody knows it. It's this open secret now.
Absolutely. That is one of the primary focus that we have internally working on, looking at the workforce issues that are at hand. As we are pushing all programs to not only be a healthy and safe place for the children to come while their parents are at work, but also so they can get that quality educational experience, the workforce is the primary driving force. So we are looking at scholarship programs. We also just started a wage and retention program where we actually support the educators and professionals as they work toward getting their degrees or their child development associate credentials. We want to make sure that we're trying to support them in both a wage and retention capacity because they are low-income jobs. We're also having conversations around how can we further promote these positions and these critical individuals in our children's lives as true professionals in the workforce and making sure that other industries recognize them too.
Yeah, we are at Ohio State. We have a very great scholarship program that we're doing right now where we're taking early childhood professionals who have been in the field for years, and they have had a two-year associate degree, and we're able to bring them in for free and then have them complete a bachelor's program. And we are finding every one of the people who have completed that program has increased they have gone to another position, a higher position within the early childhood field, and they are getting more money. So this is really exciting because we are increasing the capacity of the early childhood educators in there to be more highly qualified teachers. So we're really excited about the program. We hope it lasts for a long time because we just find there's been people in the field that have, although there's workshops, you know, that mm-hmm. people have had in the field, there here's a consistent upgrade in terms of a career path for them, being a more highly qualified early childhood educator.
It seems like, Kara Wente, that a lot of early childhood educators tend to be younger. And it makes me wonder, and I'm sure there's exceptions to that rule, of course, but is there an issue with burnout, too?
Burnout is clearly an issue. I think the wage is the primary issue we hear about when we're talking to the field. It is something, though, we're considering when we're looking at recruitment efforts. Are we trying to recruit the right individuals? Yes, we need to focus on those just graduating college, but we also need to look at the single mom of two kids who wants to be at the same place as her children as they're learning and she can work and also be in the same environment. So I think there's a couple different facets that we're looking at from the workforce perspective. I think we're also focused on the career ladder, looking at getting them in the door and getting them trained in the professional development that we need and getting them maybe in a credential first and then leading them into that associate's and bachelor's degree work as we progress.
Lori Katz, is there a model out there? Is there a state that's doing everything right? I venture to guess probably not. It's usually just pockets of people pulling something off. But
I think there is a national effort. I've been on an infant toddler panel from the government, and I think there is a national effort to really increase the capacity of not only early childhood educators, but infant toddlers particularly. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of focus on the years of preschool, but now we're looking more on infants and toddlers, which I think is really critical. I don't want to say there's a model, but I think they're doing... the universities are developing programs in a way that's working with the population that they're working with. Like right now, we have a very non-traditional group of early childhood educators. We're working with women in their 60s, 65 years old. A lot where our early childhood educators younger have been very white and monolingual. We are finding this group is very different. They've been in the field for over 10 years. I'm very excited about the career path that we have in this program. But I think with the bachelor's program, we have to look at the university's requirements as well as the early childhood. We have a very good program called Creative Pedagogies, where we're not just teaching one curriculum, because it's not the curriculum per se, but it's that really that highly qualified teacher and how she or he or they can develop a curriculum that have those critical features to promote the whole child.
And I don't want to, we don't have a lot of time left, but Kara Wente, I wanted to talk about the $24 million increase in investments over the 2-year span of the budget for early intervention services for kids who have tested positive for lead and babies born with neonatal abstinence syndrome, withdrawal, I guess, is they're going through some kind of withdrawal from drugs or alcohol. Particularly when it comes to the lead issue, it seems like it's going to be a growing problem across the country, as we've seen in Flint and other places now, that it wasn't limited to Flint, the problem with the lead pipes.
Correct. And I think that's why this is one of the first times we've seen the General Assembly put some real dollars into lead testing and, in some situations, abatement. We're looking at not only trying to test homes, but also looking at it from a child care perspective. Mm-hmm. If these kids are in these homes from, 8 to 5, we're taking a holistic approach. And from the early intervention side, you're seeing cross-agency collaboration to try to identify the best path forward for those dollars to get the biggest return on investment, to identify and then take the appropriate next steps to get rid of the issue.
Without shutting them down.
Correct. That is the ultimate promise and the message is that we're really looking at this to help test and identify the issue and then figure out what are the short-term and long-term solutions to remediating it.
Well, once again, I feel like we're just scratching the surface, but that's all the time we have. Kira Wente, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you so much for your time.
Kira Wente is Assistant Director for Health and Human Services at the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services. She's been talking about what Governor Mike DeWine signed into law in the state operating budget this past summer that deals with early childhood education issues. And also Lori Katz, Professor of Early Childhood Education in the Department of Teaching and Learning at Ohio State. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me. This is such a critical topic.
And thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.